closet metalheads. I ran into Lenny Kaye in Austin at a gig at the Continental Club. I'm like, Lenny Kaye, married to Patti Smith. They're like, wow, I've listened to your music since the 70s. Oh, awesome to meet you. What did we talk about for an hour? Metal. It was like dude in a cowboy hat talking to Lenny Kaye, and we're talking about the Sword and, you know, other, you know, Swedish black metal bands and Norwegian death metal bands and stuff like that. So,
but I mean, that seems weird because you come from an era where it was more segregated. Like, if you were a punker and you went to see some folk guy, you'd have to turn in all of your piercings. You know, you'd be kicked out of the club.
But see, I never adhere to that. Even in the early 80s, I was living in Detroit, and I looked like Travis Bickle from Taxi Driver in a mohawk and an army jacket and cowboy boots. I looked like Skid Row punk rock kid. And in the early 80s, you didn't hang out at the mall if you looked like that. They would throw you out of a shopping mall if you looked like that. You know, I was subject to a lot of social pressures as a result of my look. But I was playing in jazz clubs. I'd go play in like an all-black club in downtown Detroit, backing up jazz artists. And I was this scrawny white kid with a mohawk, and the patrons were just looking at me like, fool, what's wrong with your hair? What, man, look at you. But I could play a bass, so I was cool. And I'd hang out in these places and get, I mean, interested people, like, saying, well, what's with you? I was like, well, yeah, I listen to a bunch of really sketchy industrial punk rock stuff, but I love jazz. I love Bud Powell and Charlie Mingus. And yeah. Charlie Parker and Thelonious Monk. I didn't play that music, so that's where I started.
Yeah,
and then Big Sugar, my former band. You know, we went from playing in jazz clubs in Toronto and after hours country bars to playing arena rock, basically a reggae band playing rock and roll.
Right.
So I've never played by those rules.
Yeah, a friend of mine in just a "what are you doing today" kind of moment remembered Big Sugar and the Mahones on a bill together.
Maybe at the Key to Bala, or yeah, that sounds familiar. Yeah, I bet we did do that.
It was the beginning of it was sort of a kickoff to a period of great debauchery in his life.
And, oh, and no, it was really?
It was a great foray.
Smoking and drinking, or were we? I see.
It was a great foray. Let's start. Can you give me an audio drop? Just this is Gordy Johnson from Grady, and you're listening to Indie Ken Radio.
Hey, this is Gordy Johnson from Grady, and you are listening to Indie Ken Radio.
Last night you played the Mod Club.
Yes, I did.
And you said something that sounded very sincere. You said, hey, thanks for coming out. I didn't know if you guys would come out. Like, it's like hosting a party. I hope, you know, everybody comes or I'm going to be a fool. Do you still feel that way?
Always, yeah. Perpetually. I think all through my career, there's always that moment when you're in the dressing room and you don't hear a buzz in the room, and you just get this sinking feeling in your gut that, what if no one comes? What if this is the show where people decide, now we're tired of this, guys? Nonsense. You know, like, there's always that moment of, how's it going over there? Is anybody out there? Oh, yeah, dude, it's packed. Phew.
Yeah.
Yeah, always still have that. I guess some artists they might take it for granted. I never did. Even when we were doing arena shows years ago, I never took it for granted. Every night I walked on stage was like, oh, you're kidding. Oh, you shouldn't have. Oh, you really, you care. Oh, that's fantastic. You know, it's a nice feeling to have when you walk out there and see people who just really, really, really care about what you're doing. And because I'm there to entertain them. Otherwise, I wouldn't leave home. I would just sit. I'd be in Texas playing my banjo on the porch, you know?
Now, it's part of it a Toronto thing? I mean, is Toronto kind of like a big brother? You want to have some separation from Toronto, but you also seek its approval? Or is this the same for before any show anywhere.
It'll be the same in Kenora.
Yeah.
For me, because every venue is Massey Hall. Every night is New Year's Eve. You know, if you're me, you get to. If you're me, every night is a weekend night. Every night's New Year's Eve. It's all. Mondays mean nothing. Tuesday means nothing. For every day, it's Friday. You know, so I play every show like it's the last one, in a way, because we have had brushes with mortality in our time out there on tour. I have friends who've died mid-performance. You know, I've had guys who never got out of the dressing room or out of the hotel room and didn't make it to the show. And that, when it touches your life, you know, when it's right in front of you and you see that happen, it changes your, I don't know, just how serious you are about what it is you're doing and how much commitment you make to it emotionally and physically. Every night we walk on stage, it really is like, if this is the last night anyone ever saw me, I want people to go, well, you know, I was at that show and you wouldn't have believed it. That's, yeah. It's not too much to ask, I think.
Yeah. Now, you've said before that Jen, well, you probably saw each other in Sydney.
Oh, would that be the night you pulled the fire alarm at the Delta?
Yeah.
Were you outside in the freezing cold with 300 other ECMA partiers who were hoofed out of the hotel? Someone pulled the fire alarm. And so we're out there freezing cold. No one's got their, wouldn't let anyone get their jackets. Everyone out of the hotel. And someone pulled it out a guitar and got up on someone's shoulders and started playing Stand By Me.
Yeah.
And the entire crowd was singing Stand By Me for 10 minutes. While the firefighters and police were like in a foul mood.
Why don't I have video of that?
We don't necessarily want documentation.
That was a pretty unbelievable moment. That was just,
yeah.
I thought, oh, what's happened to the ECMAs? What, someone has to spoil the party? What's wrong with this? This isn't right. This is not what we come here for. This is what we come here for. Now we're drinking in the street, freezing cold, singing Stand By Me at, you know, 5 in the morning. Okay, I get it.
Yeah, but it's back to normal.
Yeah, it's back to normal.
But speaking of playing, I mean, you said before, you know, you'd be happy to do it all the time, play all day, every day. I mean, is that always true, or is there a reclusive side to Gordy Johnson that just wants to be alone with his guitar and have nobody else around?
I don't actually play guitar by myself very often. I'm not a really a recreational musician. I don't recall the last time I was, actually, because I've been a professional since I was a teenager. I started to get paid play music before I was done school or before I ever had, like, a weekend job as a kid. Never had a paper route, never worked at a fast food, nothing.
Right.
I always did this or worked on a farm. That's the only two things I've really ever done. So, because I'm always doing it professionally, when I'm not doing a show or in the studio, I tend to be, like, cooking or tinkering with my cars or chasing my horses around or, like, chasing my kids around. I don't have my head in music other times. And then when it's music, it's all music.
Right.
But it's kind of like just something I do. You know, I just do it. What else would I be doing? I don't really know any other thing to do.
And, well, we talked earlier about your work ethic. You seem to be always working, if not with Jay Sparrow or Joel Plaskett, it's Tim Chasen. And, like, how did you even find out who he was? Was he one of these kids who handed you a CD during load-in or load-out? And, you know, I mean, you have interesting... Well, tell the story again of how you found the Trues.
Well, the Trues, literally... I don't recall if it was a sound check, load in, load out, dude, listen to our record. It came from somewhere. I had a stack of records, and I was driving somewhere by myself and was just listening to demos and throwing them in the seat next to me and listen to this one's no good, threw that one out. And I heard a demo, and went, yeah, no, this one's not ready to come out of the oven yet. Checked it aside. And it was a couple of months later, I got another demo. Larry Wanagas, who was managing Big Sugar at the time, took an interest in these kids and had a demo. And said, well, you may never have heard of this, but I have this demo by a band called Trouser, which is a nice band name. I thought, well, I've heard them. Gee, they sure weren't very good. But what do you got? He gave me another demo, and I listened to it. And I thought, yeah, they're just okay. I don't know. Keep me abreast of the situation. And it was a rainy, cold, like probably November night in Toronto. I was home with my wife, all nice and cozy in the house by the fire. And Larry had been calling her saying, you got to get him out to see this band. I'm going to go see them tonight at Jeff Healy's. You got to get Cordy to come out and see Trouser. She was like, look, Larry really wants you to go and see this band. I'm like, oh, we're drinking wine. We're all tucked in. Really, oh, I don't feel like going out tonight. She like handed me my coat and said, go. All right. So she got the reclusive millionaire out of the house. So I looked it up on Wikipedia. It says I'm a millionaire recluse, and so I'm sticking by that. That's my only connection to the internet. So I went and stood there in the club, and the band went on stage, and I went, wow, okay, I get it. Now I get it. Still a lot of work to be done with them, but I heard the potential as soon as I walked on stage in the first song. I thought, these guys want it so bad. Had a meeting with them, and I could just tell by their faces. These guys want it so bad. It was palpable. I thought, okay, I'll do whatever we need to do to help you guys, which meant going in the studio. And, you know, for about a year, almost 2 years, I took them in the studio, a couple of different intervals. They weren't quite ready. Took them on tour as an opening act. 2, 3 shows, 4 shows, 5 shows, a month of shows, which turned into 6 months of shows, which turned into, like, they were our only opening act for an entire album cycle.
Right.
I just needed to get these guys out there and see how it's done and go out there and do your thing. I watched their show every night and gave them notes every night. They wanted it so bad. Then I went away for a while. I left Toronto. I made their first record, and the boys. And every so often I hook up with them and we write songs, and they've recorded songs I've written with them and for them over the years and their records. And great, and look at them now. They're all grown up, big rock stars, making awesome records and put on such amazingly consistent shows. And I just, they're like, I mean, they could be my sons, you know? I'm so proud of them. And now they're not kids to me, you know? Now they're contemporaries.
Yeah.
I'm like, wow, that's the greatest thing, is the greatest feeling too.
Well, you really honor the next generation. All of your shows, whoever opens for you, you finish your show with the lead guitarist, lead singer coming out and doing a song with you, and that really tells the audience that you know that they're not absolutely right. And how did that start, and how did it become a habit?
I don't know. You know, there's a bit of paying it forward, because a lot of my heroes over the years, for no reason whatsoever, have apparently just shown me, like, great acts of kindness that really altered my career path. I spoke to Alex Lifeson from Rush this week. I met him years and years ago when I was a jazz musician, actually. I met him at a cigar connoisseur dinner somewhere. Go figure. Al, I'd like you to meet Gordy. Gordy, this is Al. Hi, Al. I met Al. What a lovely gentleman. Talked about golfing and cigars and music and whatnot. And it wasn't till several months later, I was in a recording studio and I dropped by a studio to borrow some equipment. And the owner of the studio said, look, I gotta hustle you guys out of here. I don't mean to be rude, but Rush is in here and you can't be in here. Like, it's really private. They don't want anybody around. So as we were walking out the door, who was walking in? Oh, Al. Oh, Gordy Johnson, right? Yeah, Alex Lifeson. Whoa.
That Al.
The Bytor and the Snow Dog Yeah, that guy, Tom Sawyer. Oh, right. Wow, man. And he just instantly took us through the studio, showed us the studio and all their gear, and these are the songs we're working on, and what are you doing? I said, well, I'm recording a Big Sugar record. Cool, man. Well, come and see the guitars. And looking at his guitars, I was like, wow, the white double neck.
Yeah. He's another
I said, Al, I saw you play that guitar in 1977. My dad took me to see Rush at Cobo Arena in Detroit when I was a teenager. My first concert, Rush. Still have the ticket stub.
2112 tour?
No, I think it would have been Hemispheres. Yeah. Farewell to Kings or Hemispheres. Yeah. I saw those tours, but there it was. It was like, I didn't think it could be possible that, well, there it is. Of course, it has to be somewhere. Of course, it's at your recording session. He goes, oh, yeah, the white one. Well, I'll tell you the truth. I haven't played it in years. It really is heavy, and it was messing up my golf swing, man. I was like, it hurts my back. I just don't play it anymore. I'm like, oh, my God. You don't play it. Wow. So he took it down off the wall and gave it to me and said, why don't you take it and see if it brings you good luck.
Wow. That's that guitar?
Why? Why would you do that to me? I'm just a kid. I'm just in the studio by chance. I met you one night. He's heard my band play with Molly Johnson or whatever. Just, hey, you're a good guitar player. Why don't you see if it brings you luck? And completely altered the course of my career and life as a musician. And it was like, take Excalibur, go slay dragons from now on. You know, it's like, wow, it's enchanted. And we literally just put it on a stand in the studio and was like, it was just an icon, that like an idol we prayed to it every day. It just sat on the stand until I was brave enough to pull it from the stone and, you know, slay the dragons with it. And it just changed the sound of Big Sugar, and it just changed my whole course. I don't know where we would have gone without that moment, but it's random act of kindness from one of my first musical heroes as a kid, and there it was. It actually happened to me. That's a true story. It actually happened to me. So I look at that and go, really? Every so often, I just, for no reason, take a guitar that I really love and is have done amazing creative things with it and just handed it to some kid and said, I think you're awesome. Take this and go forth. You know, it just, you got to do that every so often because it makes you better. I think the giver benefits more than the receiver in a way.
Does that mean your red double neck with the Canadian flag on the back is gone? I didn't see it last night.
No, because that is a Big Sugar guitar. See, my Big Sugar guitars still live here. I've got the white one and the red one, and they're tuned for doing Big Sugar shows. I've got a bunch of guitars that go on those gigs. The Grady guitars are all brown or black or something, and they're slung really low, and it's just sort of a more metal approach, so they have different set of guitars for that presentation. So the Big Sugar guitars live here for when and if we feel like doing that.
I'm going to ask you a little bit about that later, sure. But I want to ask you about Good Is Dead, the new Grady album. With all these people you've worked with, I wondered the first time I saw it if there'd be some of these influences, but you listen to what you did, and that's a Grady song. Unmistakable. Do you find you're influenced, or is Grady music a certain style in itself that you have to be true to?
Well, telling you the truth, I don't put much thought to it. I suppose it comes out sounding more. Well, that's your gig. I can analyze it after the fact for you. I can look at it and listen to it and go, oh, well, you know what? Here we were just talking about Rush. And there are certain songs on the record that now when I listen back to it, I go, well, that's actually kind of progressive. I mean, I love me some John Lee Hooker and some Lightnin' Hopkins, but I also love Pantera and Rush and ZZ Top and High on Fire. Like, I've got really broad, you know, Dead Kennedys. I listen to Killing Joke. I've got a really broad spectrum of stuff that I just dig. Willie Nelson, you know. So it's kind of peculiar now listening back to it. I go, oh, I totally hear the Rush influence in that, the early 70s Rush, kind of progressive, heavy riffs, loud, there's drum solos every now and then, just stuff like that. And I go, you know, odd song structures, and I go, wow, I wasn't thinking about it. I was listening to Waylon Jennings the day we did this.
Yeah.
But it came out. I ingested it, and we just sweated it out later. But I hear all those things in the record now when I listen to it. But at the time, we were just in the studio playing music. It's all you can do. I think if you make it too on purpose, then it sounds sort of earnest for the wrong reasons. And I hear that in other bands, and I'm highly critical of it. But when I hear someone who's just in the flow and being themselves, wow, there's nothing better. And it is fun to pull it apart and see if you can, you know, pick out the ingredients, you know.
Right,
exactly. It's kind of like if you're a wine taster, you know, like you can taste licorice and leather and smoky undertones of blah, blah, blah. I once stuck a glass of wine under the nose of my 6-year-old son. I was drinking some, you know, 20-year-old bottle of Barolo or something. And I was like, well, you know, the mind, the senses of a child, there's so much more, you know, he has the uncluttered mind and experience, and his olfactory, you know, thing is just developing. It would be fantastic. I'll just, hey, buddy, come here, smell Papa's wine. Well, what do you mean? Well, smell it. Put your nose in there. What do you smell? What would you say you smelled? Well, what do you mean, Pop? So, well, do you smell chocolate candies, or do you smell roses, or do you smell wood? What do you smell? And he put his nose up to the glass and he went, grapes. And you know, sometimes music is a bit like that. What are the influences? Grapes.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's, to me, my music is grapes. You can smell licorice and leather, and it's slate, I suppose, if you try hard enough, but it's grapes.
Yeah. Well, meanwhile, I'm always trying to figure out what they were listening to on the way to the studio when they made that record, you know. But sometimes it's more basic than that.
It's not always, yeah, it's not always what you think, because I drive my Jeep to the studio, or I've got an old vintage car, it just has AM radio. So I just listen to Tejano stations. I listen to the Mexican stations, because accordion music sounds killer on AM radio, and that's all I listen to. So when I'm driving around, I listen to that. Now, I'm on my way to go see Slayer, but I'm listening to a bunch of Mexican guys singing in Spanish, playing accordion. I don't know.
I get the feeling Ben certainly feels like this is his band. He's a part of Grady. Yeah. Do you feel like Nina feels like she's a part of the band now?
I think now she does, yeah. She's been with us almost 3 years. And the new record, I think, definitely her. It wouldn't have been the same record without her. With a different drummer, we might have taken a whole different approach. The three records we have sound different from each other, largely because there's a different, you know, there's only three ingredients in the recipe. So when you take a major component like the drumming, yeah, it definitely has a different sound to it. So, and you know, her singing is a big part of the sound now too, because the two of us sing so much together. And it's pretty funny because she's like a 90-pound Punjabi girl. She's 3 feet tall or whatever. I mean, she's this tiny thing. I can lift her up in the air before the show as a warm up, but she can do a spot on imitation of my vocal. She can double my vocal and it sounds like I doubled it, but it's her. She
wow.
does a really funny, I think it's as for a joke initially, but she can imitate my vocals perfectly. When you hear the two of us talk, you wouldn't actually believe she could do that. But that's a cool trick. So I employed it. I'm like, great, I'm not doubling any of my vocals in the studio. You're going to do it.
Now, yeah, just for...
It's become part of the sound.
Yeah, for anyone who doesn't know, it's the world's smallest drummer behind the world's largest drum kit.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And she, you know, she won out of an audition of about, I don't know, 8 or 10 guys. And these guys were just beasts. I mean, they came in and they were just pounding the drums. A lot of good drummers, you can imagine. There's a lot of good musicians in the Austin area. She came in, tiny wisp of a thing, and without even trying. I think that's why she got the gig, because she just didn't even have to try that hard. She was like, wow, you got something that's beyond muscle, that's just beyond showing off. You're just, that's just the way she plays. And I have great admiration for musicians like that.
How long ago did you write the lyric, Feeling Twice My Age?
About half my age ago, funnily enough. If I do the math, well, there you go. Yeah.
And so back then, how you are now looked very different to you then, I guess.
You know, I suspected it would probably go about like this. Yeah.
Oh, really? No kidding.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
And I mean, that is a lyric that's resonated. It's from a Big Sugar tune that, incidentally, your show doesn't always have a Big Sugar tune, but it does always have Tom Sawyer. That, just back to what we said.
We actually, think we built into the set last night, we played Working Man, which is from the first Rush record.
Yeah.
So there was a little tip of the hat there last night. We, you know, wherever we can, put a little shout out in. There's a little ZZ Top moment in the show, too. You know, just anything we can do to just, you know.
Yeah.
It's like pouring out a little bit of wine for the for the spirits, you know.
Now, I remember reading about, you know, sort of the end of the Big Sugar era, the beginning of the Grady era. And I don't know if I saw you say it or I could imagine you saying it. You felt like at the time you were in a cover band of yourself. Was that part of why Big Sugar came to a close?
Yeah, I didn't feel like that. But I didn't want to feel like that.
Right.
I didn't want it to become that. And there were forces gathering around me that were feeling, I think, that it was far more lucrative to just putting on the costume, going out there and playing the hits. We're not doing anything new now. We've established this thing. We just want you to keep doing that. Which is all good and fine, but I've never done that. And I'd never had anybody's advice or help or counseling. I felt like we're making a lot of people a lot of money, and this is all good and fine, but we're doing it by being artists and staying true to what we do. And that's why people like us, and that's why we're all making money. When you want to make us stop doing that, do you see what's going to happen? I'll be, you know... Give me 10 more years of that, and I'll be an alcoholic who hates his job. And I don't want to be that person. I want to do this because I love it. And that's the only reason I'll ever do it. So rather than watch something I loved and put my entire being into for a decade and a half, I thought, well, I'm going to take my pail and shovel, and I'm going to go find another sandbox to play in. Thank you very much. So, yeah, there was no personal dispute in the band. Our last tour was just all love and family. And I don't harbor any resentment to anybody, record labels, managers, agents. I mean, everyone did a great job and made a great thing happen. But it was time to move on and continue to do something vital and new, which is Grady. I wasn't going to be able to write the songs and play the way I play now in Big Sugar, because that's not what people wanted from Big Sugar. They didn't expect that. And I respect my audience. If they want to hear Big Sugar, they want to hear the songs they know and love. So I'm either going to do that or not do it. I don't pretend that Grady is Big Sugar Part 2. It was never intended to be. If we ever did any songs that were from the Big Sugar era, we had to do them like Grady. I only do songs that were my songs. They weren't Big Sugar songs. They were songs, I'll play them on a banjo. I'll play them in my acoustic set. I'll play them as Grady. We played them as Big Sugar. But not every Big Sugar song would be adaptable. It would never play Turn the Lights On with Grady.
Yeah.
We couldn't. It just wouldn't be sincere. It wouldn't be right. It wouldn't fit. It wouldn't be in good taste, I don't think. When Big Sugar plays it, there's nothing better. It's the most fun you can have. So I try to keep those things separate.
Now, are you part of the snowboarding culture in Austin, Texas?
The snowboarding culture, yes, which is very vibrant. Not really.
You know what I'm getting at? There's been some rumors, and you've dodged some questions about a Big Sugar, either show, reunion, maybe a tour. What are you prepared to say about that?
Well, I hadn't really thought of it as a reunion. Like, we're not having a great big, like, we're not throwing a big party or a big, like, press conference or anything. Like, you know, someone asked us to come and play. Snowboarders, Whistler, big snowboarding thing is going on at the end of this month, and they wanted Big Sugar to come and play. I was like, well, I don't know if there is a Big Sugar. I'm not going to say no. Like, I don't dislike the songs or anything, or the guys. So I was in Toronto for a week. I called up all the guys. I was like, well, do you want to get together and rehearse or play? Do you feel like doing it? If anybody said no, then I guess the answer would have been no. But everyone said yes, and we got together and played, and it was great. It was instantly great. It was instantly great fun, and it felt new, and I remembered how much I like playing this stuff, so we're going to go do the gig. There's been now a couple of other offers to play gigs in this summer, and I guess I'll go and do them, because, you know, I just remembered how much fun it is to play that stuff. The new band is getting established, and it's up and running, and the shows are doing great, and people like what we do, so, you know, I don't have to forsake one for the other.
Right.
I have a lot of energy and a lot of will to do it, so you know, the gig in Whistler for the snowboarders will be interesting, because I got to do a Big Sugar concert like from 4 till 6, and then a Grady show from midnight till 2 the same day. So I'll let you know how that works out. If I just, I'm a little, you know, just I'll be reduced to cinders and ashes by the end of it, but yeah, we'll see how that goes.
Yeah. Well, that said, I'll call that a commitment. Diane, have you taught Gordy how to Twitter? Can we get that information right off?
I'm Twittering for you.
Yeah.
Okay. So she's your Twitterer.
My ghost tweeter. I had to, you know what? I mean, I live in the physical realm. I'm a country guy. Like, if I, you know, I only know it is what it is when I step in it. You know what I mean? There's a, does it smell like? Does it look like I stepped in it? Yes, it is. So part of, I mean, I've had people pressuring me for years to get a cell phone. And even getting a cell phone was a big leap for me. I only got one because at the time my wife was pregnant. I was like, okay, and then we got babies. I need my kids to have my cell phone number. My kid is 3,000 miles from me, but he needs to call me if he needs to call me. Mm-hmm. So I got a cell phone. But I don't have an email address. I turn on a computer. I don't know how to do it. My wife's got a computer. I like, every time I touch it, something bad happens. It's part, you know, I feel like it's part of what, I mean, my interpretation of music is what it is, because I only come to know things by actually knowing them, by actually touching them. How do you like to reach out to your fans? By Facebook or Twitter or what, or the whatever? You know, like, my favorite way of reaching out to my fans is with my hand. Yeah. There'll be a beer bottle in my hand and one in your hand, and we'll go clink, and then we've connected. There's my friend request. Do you flash me horns at the show? That's my friend request. You're my friend now. You know me. You want me your picture taken with me? Why not? We're in this together. Great. It's not my world. I love people talking about me on it. And go ahead. I mean, I'm sure there's stuff on there you can download and look at, film of me doing something somewhere. That's all good. That's fine. But, you know, I mean, if you go to the zoo to see the tiger, does the tiger know he's a tiger? Does he put on the stripes because you're showing up at the zoo? No. He woke up a tiger. I woke up Grady today. You know what I mean? I put on the cowboy boots, not for show. I put them on because I put them on. And I was just doing what I was doing. And I'm doing it for people, but I have to be on the other side of that relationship. I can't be on both sides of it. I don't feel like I can be. Like, you don't need to know. And I was joking with Diane earlier that people on Twitter don't need to know that I just bought nail clippers. If you think elves show up while I sleep and trim my nails and make my hands good for guitar playing, you should believe that. Maybe it's true. I don't know.
Well, both Jen Martin and Diane Foy in the studio here with us would call that a rationalization and want you on Facebook right away. But it sounds like religion to me.
I like it.
Let's go back to production just for a minute. Is there always a talk you have with a band or artist you're working for the first time? Do you find they come with unrealistic expectations in terms of what you can do for them, or realistic expectations, or do you have to, sort of set the tone, or how does that relationship usually kick off?
Well, I have to take a very pragmatic look at somebody's dreams and aspirations, basically. Someone's artistic intent. I like the artist, as a producer, I like the artist to come in and feel completely unshackled. They have to be able to dream as big a dream as they can. Let me worry about how we make that happen. And I think the skills you develop as a producer and an engineer really come down to problem solving and removing obstacles from the artist. I like to use Joel Plaskett as an example. Some artists I work with, I will work with them, like we'll sit down and write the songs. Mm-hmm. I will help them find a better amplifier, better guitar in which to communicate their musical vision. A lot of guys don't honestly know the ins and outs of the equipment. I can hear what they're trying to say, and if they're not communicating, for example, I'll suggest a different guitar, a different amp, put it in a different key that's better for your voice. Just little practical things like that. An artist like Joel Plaskett, for example, I'm not going to need to say any of that to him. He's got a vision in his mind. These are the songs. This is why. Like, I'll spend the first several days with Joel Plaskett drinking wine and listening to records that have nothing to do with what we're doing. Or do they? He'll just play me a random selection of cool old vinyl records that he just thinks are funny, insightful, inspiring, whatever. We'll have a few laughs. When we actually get down to working, slowly I'll start to realize this was a frame of reference for where we're going. He doesn't say it in so many words, mm-hmm. but that's part of his artistry. He kind of just shows you his hand before you sit down at the card table. Oh, okay, I know where he's coming from. And I just intuitively then know what I have to do to get, I'm just his linebacker, just get obstacles out of his way. How are we going to do this? I'll worry about that. You just go. You just run. I'm the pit crew. I'll put new tires on and gas it up. Run that car as fast as you can. And I think that's one creative relationship that I'm most proud of, and that I've been a great enabler for ideas that were already there, and sounds and lyrics and all the stuff that were there and needed to be presented.
Right.
You know. So that's sort of the pinnacle of what you can achieve, I think, in an artist-producer relationship. Warren Haynes of Government Mule is another example of a guy who shows up with the goods already. He knows what he wants to do. I know what he digs. I just make it happen for him. He doesn't need my help as a songwriter, but he'll play me songs and say, I don't know, man. Does this belong in Government Mule? Does this belong on this record? And I'll often listen to it and go, as a fan, I absolutely know perfectly how to represent this. Yes, you're right. Let's go with this. You know. And then we have a relationship where he'll defer to me, and I'll say to him, I think you should play it on this guitar. I think the drums should approach it like this. And this is all stuff that they already have a frame of reference for, and it'll be a perfect Government Mule song. And that's worked to such an amazingly effective, you know, result that we continue to have a relationship that way, creatively. And those are just, you know, two examples of the best it can get to. Working with baby bands, there's a lot more hands-on help with songwriting, arranging, helping the guys get their tones. But you hopefully, you know, you need to get your batter up to the plate, and yeah, you want to see them hit that home run. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't swing the bat for you. I can't do that. Yeah. You're the guy. You stand at the plate. Ball comes to you, swing. You know, I just got to get them ready.
Right,
for that
exactly.
Moment.
Yeah, so you're fairly adaptable. I mean, some, you know, to use the baseball analogies, some managers are great to get a brand new team to a 500 team, but they're not the right manager to get them from a 500 team to a playoff team, and that might not be the right manager to get them to the, you know, winning it all. But you like tinkering in all of those areas.
Well, yeah, I mean, I can't. I like seeing people in any stage of their creative development. You know, like to go back to that example of the Trues earlier, where they were not amazing when I got them, but I knew they could be.
Yeah.
And now I've had, you know, a decade of seeing them become as amazing as their potential hinted at back in the day. And that's, I'm proud to be any part of that continuum, you know, to get people to another level of being able to do what they do.
Good as dead is kind of an oxymoron. I mean, it's really nothing good about being dead. The album, was it a collection of songs where you were at now, or was it, did this album have a mission being the third Grady album?
You know, there's parts of it that are somewhat humorous.
Mm-hmm.
And parts of it that are really way darker than her other stuff, because that's what life hands you. You know, like, I've had friends pass away recently, and it's kind of eerie because a lot of the record was sort of inspired by and aimed directly at a person in my life who's now departed since the record's come out. So now I look at that record and go, ouch, wow, that hurts. But mm-hmm. At the same time, life has handed us humor, and, you know, I mean, there's a truck driving song on there. There's a Willie Nelson, you know, honky tonk anthem on there. There's accordion on there. There's fiddle on there. But these are all things that I have a physical connection to in my life. I hear accordion music every day. How could I not have Tejano accordion on my record? It's what I listen to every day. Gotta have that. Tim Chason from PEI spent almost a year working with that kid on his record. Great pop songwriter, great singer, cute as a bug. Man, I love this kid. What a great, that's the whole package of talented kid, humble. Turns out he comes from a fiddling, a Prince Edward Island fiddle dynasty. He's like the youngest of 50 amazing fiddlers. So how can I not have this kid play fiddle on my record? He's a huge influence on me. He doesn't know that.
Yeah.
He, you know, he thinks I'm an influence on him. Well, guess what, buddy? I got something out of it, too. His fiddle playing, to me, is like just this. It's a cultural expression. It's not even like a professional music thing. It's just a cultural entity more than anything. So I wanted a snapshot of that culture in my record. You know, the music of Ireland and Scotland and the Canadian Maritimes influences me, so I had to include it in there. So yeah, I guess in the analysis of it, yeah, it's a snapshot of all the things going on with me and us in that time frame.
Mm-hmm.
It's all, yeah, it's all for real. There were nothing was done as a toss off or we need a song like this.
Right. You weren't trying to find the radio song.
No.
Yeah.
Not. I was never trying to find the radio song actually at any point. It's sort of miraculous to me that any of those Big Sugar songs got played on the radio. Because if you listen to what was on the radio at that time, it wasn't nothing sounding like that. I'm the only artist, to my knowledge at least, I'm the only artist, I think, that on the same day in Toronto, we got played on the classic rock station, we got played on The Edge, the new music station, and we got played on The Flow, which was the new urban hip-hop station, the same day.
Right,
the
Grady,
same
you
song.
You did that with Grady.
No, with Big Sugar.
Oh,
we did that with Big Sugar.
Right,
the same day.
The sort of reggae feel, you got the rock feel.
Classic rock, modern rock, and the hip-hop station. They all played it the same day. I was like, why isn't anybody writing about this in a newspaper? This has got to be worth something, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, at the end of the day, it's only worth something to the people that heard it on the radio and dug it. I mean, I was just, to me, just tickled. I felt like I got away with something.
Well, the problem is no one's listening to all three of those radio stations.
Well, except me.
Let's see. I just want to finish with, I mean, Austin, I mean, I don't know if you moved there because you really wanted to have a definitive break from what people expected of you, and that would help it. You certainly say there's a lot of great songwriting there. You attribute Eastern Canada as just a wealth of great songwriting. I mean, in that breath, are you dissing Nashville in some way, or is this just your experience?
You know, I love Austin because it's a music town. It's not a music industry town. It's a music town. There is no industry there. There's not a bunch of managers and record labels. No one showcases in Austin unless it's South by Southwest. And really, South by Southwest is not Austin. It's its own entity. It becomes a city unto itself, South by Southwest. And a lot of people only know it for what that is.
Mm-hmm.
Great. You know, fantastic. I mean, it's a wonderful thing once a year. Any random Tuesday night, I'll take a drive through the city and just see people who are doing it only because they love it, and they're only playing it for people who also just love it. Everyone in Austin, when they get done work or whatever, they go someplace and hear live music, because that's what you do in Austin. There is a live band.
Mm-hmm.
There's somebody sitting there picking a guitar or a fiddle or a pedal steel or in a punk metal band somewhere. No one's getting rich doing it. We're not making a bunch of money doing it. There's just not a lot of... You're splitting the door with four other bands most nights, and we don't need to get rich doing it in Austin. You just do it because you're doing cool music. We're not the only cowboy metal band in Austin. They don't exist anywhere else, by the way. You know, but there's just dudes who wear Wranglers and wear cowboy hats and work shirts and play Gibson guitars through Marshalls and metal out when they can. And it's nothing to listen to Slayer and Willie Nelson the same day for some of us. It's just all good, isn't it? We just love music. So I take a great deal of inspiration just from the place and people's attitude and how important music is to them. Now, I'm not going to diss Toronto out loud, but, you know, I really found like Toronto, for a time, was becoming a city where every gig was a showcase, and everybody's always networking and, like, schmoozing. And in Austin, no one's ever networking or schmoozing or showcase. We're not showcasing. We're showboating.
Yeah.
We're just showing off. We're going to do this whether you're here or not. But turns out people are there. So, but I have to say, I have seen a resurgence of creativity in this city, Toronto, Canada. Of late, I heard a lot of people that I knew from back in the good old days. There's always some good old days, you know, to complain about that are gone. How, you know, Queen Street was this great hotbed of creativity and artists and musicians of all genres and just such a creative time. And there were reggae clubs on that same strip. And, oh, man, it's just not like that anymore. But you know what? It's just moved to another part of the city. They're amazingly creative people who are just... They're playing marching band instruments in a bar somewhere. There's a guy behind a bar serving drinks playing trumpet at the same time. I mean, there's just incredible gatherings of people doing beautiful creative music, and they're not relying on any kind of industry support. And that's always been here, and that's great. I think Toronto's a fortunate city that it continues to accidentally spawn these bursts of creativity. So I'm sure that'll burn out at some point, and then all those people complain that, oh man, it's just not like what it used to was.
Not like it was in decade two of the
20. So,
what are we in, the 22nd century? Whatever.
They'll just have to 21st century.
21st.
They'll have to just.
Only off by 1,000 years.
Yeah, I have a better watch than you do. They look it up on the internet. They. They just have to look in another neighborhood. You know, like as neighborhoods become affluent, artists can't afford to live there anymore. So
yeah.
Queen, like where the Drake and the Gladstone are, all those places where these art galleries are, and eventually the art galleries are going to have to move out because no one can afford to live in that neighborhood. Then they'll have to find out where Cracktown moves to after they kick all the crackheads out, and then that'll be where artists gather and congregate and burned out old places.
Scarborough, your time is coming.
Yeah, who knows, man? Who knows where it'll move to?
Okay, just to finish up, I'm still dating the Good Is Dead album, just getting to know it. And but you've been with it for quite some time, so I want you to play.
We've slept together, okay?
Yeah,
on record is saying yes.
Absolutely. And just as another analogy, it's kind of like playing that Grady show after the Big Sugar show. It's kind of like telling your wife that you have to go see your ex just to talk about the kids, but I'll be home tonight.
Oh dear. Well, is that what it's going to be like?
I don't know, but you'll be
conversation I want to have.
Diane will be twittering us about it later. But I just want you to pick a song, a sentimental favorite from Good Is Dead, and tell us a story about this song, and we're going to finish the show with that.
Okay. Well, let's see. Well, I hate to get all heavy on you, but I alluded to it earlier. I had a dear friend who I've known since childhood who passed away recently. And I won't sugarcoat it, he drank himself to death. God bless him. And I wrote a song months and months ago that was basically a reduction of our last conversation that we had over the phone. And the song is called If I Was King. And I didn't know how it was going to turn out, but that is how it turned out. He's left us. And what I have left is the song as a reminder of it. So if you would play If I Was King, I would love that.
If That Was King. Thanks for being with us, Gordy Johnson, and thanks for sharing your music with us.
All right.
If I was king, even for a day, by tomorrow there'd be hell in all the bay. If I was king, and this world was mine too,
more information on the artists featured on today's show, visit IndieCan.com.